broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is the Bob Zeska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, April 17, 2019, and this is the Bob Zeska Show, interviews from Earth One. My guest today is the co-host of the Gaslit Nation podcast and an accomplished screenwriter, Andrea Chalupa. Not only was she my editor way back in 2009 when I wrote for AOL's Wallet Bob, but since then, Andrea has become one of the leading experts on both Soviet-era Russia and the entire Trump-Russia story. Today, we're going to talk about the origins of Russia's active measures as well as the mandate for impeachment of Donald Trump. And a whole lot more. By the way, if you like what you hear, please consider supporting my podcast at BobSeskaShow.com and also Andrea's Gaslit Nation at Patreon.com/Gaslit. And now, my conversation with the great Andrea Chalupa.
Hi.
Andrea, how are you?
Oh my gosh, I'm so great. How are you?
God, it's been like, what, like 10 years since AOL Wallet Pop. You know, Andrea, I mean, we're starting the show now, so I just want to let you know that we're underway. But
oh, we are?
Yes. Oh my God, just diving right in. If you remember back when we were working together at AOL's Wallet Pop, I spent so much time writing about Monsanto, and I learned, you know, it was great because I thought they were just poisoning people, and it turned out they were also exploiting their monopoly. They were engaging in all these intimidation tactics of farmers who would like brown bag Monsanto seeds and so on. I just wanted to say that you were maybe the best editor I ever worked with. I mean, you always made my work better and not just different. So I wanted to thank you for that, just personally here in public.
Oh my God, that is so sweet, because I was about to say, you kept me sane, because everything you brought me was so fearless and urgent, and I was just so proud to work with you.
It was like my first serious writing gig. I mean, it was writing a politics. I never earned a paycheck doing it, and that was the first job. And I was just like, I was desperately hoping that I wouldn't be seen as a joke. That's mainly the thing.
Oh my God!
I'm glad that
I was honored. I was honored. I was very proud. I was very proud to edit the great Bob Zeska. I told everyone.
Oh my God. Well, you know, and it was an honor to work with you too. And then of course you departed, and my tenure at AOL's Wallet Pop lasted very few days after that. Like, it was just like, all right, now it's over. Where did you go after that?
I got some comments about, you know, toning down the quote unquote political stuff. But as you recall, it was a time like today, I mean, like we've been experiencing for decades now, right? Institutional failure. Mm-hmm. So working in media all these years and just seeing the decline of newsrooms and the shrinking of newsroom jobs, and just seeing so many excellent reporters and editors being pushed out of the industry because the jobs are just disappearing with the whole digital disruption and hedge funds taking over really good newspapers and just gutting them for profit. And so I actually ended up at AOL from a layoff. I have the most incredible story that's straight out of a movie.
Wow.
I was working at Condé Nast at a business magazine called Condé Nast Portfolio, which was supposed to be a Vanity Fair for CEOs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like my first big, serious, impress the parents media job. And before that, I was just like fighting to get into the industry. I worked for an alternative weekly in a small town in Portland, Oregon, not a small town by any means, but I worked in various gigs that whatever I could find, trying to break in as a kid.
Yeah.
It's a very competitive industry, and having not gone to an Ivy League, you know, and then this New York City publishing, and just doing temp jobs to support myself. And so through a very hippie friend, like my hippie soulmate in high school, his dad happened to work at the LA Times and cover the LA Times for Sacramento. And he knew someone at the New York Times that went to Chico State and wasn't all like Ivy League glossy.
Wow.
And so that Chico State connection really helped connect me, because then in college I went to Chico State parties and did like a keg stand. And so that kind of helped us connect. And that was like my in into this cloistered, privileged Ivy League rarefied world of Condé Nast and New York City publishing. That was my in, was Chico State. And so I was at Condé Nast for, you know, having a great time, cutting my teeth, learning from a lot of great reporters and editors. And right when I got laid off there, when we all got laid off in our department, I was working on a story on AOL and trying to hunt down their CEO. And the moment I got that email of like all hands to the conference room, I was working on a spreadsheet of layoffs at AOL and decline in profits and getting all my ducks in a row for this big article. Yeah. And then I went to the conference room and the news was delivered. And the next thing you know, we're all drunk at a local bar. We were out of jobs. And what was really interesting is that like a former colleague at AOL called me in for an interview. And of course I went as a curious journalist to be like, oh, I'm finally on the inside. Cause in my mind, like I was still stuck in the article I was investigating.
Yeah. Right.
And so I showed up to AOL for a job interview / research. and they completely sold me on the company. And they said they had a strategy of scooping up all these laid off journalists to try to reinvent the company, and wow. I was excited by that, and I took it. You know, I was desperate for anything, and I was excited by the opportunity. And one of the first things I did was organize an event between the Huffington Post and AOL, because I had friends at the Huffington Post, and I brought AOL and the Huffington Post together,
right,
in an event about talking about the new economy and how people were coping post economic crash, and so I take credit for the AOL Huffington Post merger from that.
Yeah, where's your commission? I mean, my God, your finder's fee should have been gigantic. Call up Ariana and say, what's the deal? Andrea Chalupa needs a commission on this.
Exactly. So I had a good time there while it lasted, but I just didn't feel part of that AOL brand by any means. I was just too weird on the inside and too political. And they would, God help them, put me on TV to represent AOL. And I would do things like give people advice on television about how to order from restaurant menus. And like really, I'm not kidding, like really fiercely generic stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember my coping mechanism was having to stand up there on some like local TV news channel and deliver the most generic self-help facts. And inside I was like, just sneak in one Star Wars reference for your own self-worth. Just sneak in one Star Wars reference. And so that was, I kind of felt like this isn't me. My mom was so happy because she thought I was like on my way to the Today Show because they do my hair and makeup and make me all glossy. But inside I wanted to do something more meaningful, as you know, from working together, that with the sort of stuff I'm attracted to, like social justice issues and, you know, speaking truth to power and taking on corruption and all of it in this really critical time that we find ourselves in. So I just got out of there at one point. I downgraded my life. I moved into a really cheap apartment and just hustled freelance gigs, whatever I could find. And within 2 years, I wrote, researched, and optioned the rights to my very first screenplay, which I just produced in the last year, which is Mr. Jones.
Mr. Jones, yeah.
Mr. Jones, yeah. So I left to work on the really long shot, high risk, like, is she crazy project of trying to get my screenplay finally made.
This movie that you wrote, Mr. Jones, it's about a British journalist who attempts to uncover an international conspiracy involving the Russians. Shocking. And then you also, though, since AOL, right, you wrote a book called Orwell and the Refugees about Animal Farm, right?
Yeah.
You know, you obviously have a connection to Russia here. You have a fascination with Russian history and obviously with allegories like Animal Farm and Mr. Jones is set in Russia, too. What is the connection between you and Russia, and not even getting into Gaslit Nation and everything you're covering on the podcast?
Yeah. So this whole screenplay project, it was really nagging at me all these years. I got the idea for the first time in my final year of college at UC Davis, when I was, you know, procrastinating, supposed to be working on my very serious history thesis on the role of religion in Ukraine's attainment of independence with the fall of communism. I was really interested in the catacomb church movement. Like, what happened when you took away the opium of the people under communism? Where did they go for any sort of sense of faith and sort of spiritual longing and meaning. And so I was really interested in underground religious movements in the Soviet Union, and that's what I was supposed to be focusing on for my research. And instead, I procrastinated or took breaks from that by answering this big fat question that I always had growing up, which stemmed from my childhood. Growing up in Northern California, my grandfather, who's from Ukraine, from Donbass, Ukraine, which is right now being invaded by Russia. Mm-hmm. And so he was the world to me growing up, and right before he passed away, he left behind a memoir that he typed in Ukrainian. And I saved up money in college, and I went and backpacked in Ukraine, and I found a translator, and I got the pages back, and I started researching a screenplay because I was young and I felt like I wanted to do something meaningful and reach the most amount of people possible. And I felt that a film would be a really good way to pay justice to the countless victims of Stalin's many genocides, specifically this one genocide that my grandfather survived and bore witness to in his memoir. And so I got to work, and the whole story centered around a real life New York Times Pulitzer Prize winning Moscow bureau chief, mm-hmm. who was a huge journalistic celebrity in his day. His name was Walter Duranty, and he was known to the world as our man in Moscow. And he would go to all these parties of the Algonquin Roundtable, and everybody knew him, and he was the trusted voice of what was happening inside the Soviet Union. So his word was truth. What he published in the New York Times was taken as gospel, so much so that he even advised FDR as a candidate for president and helped broker a deal to bring the Soviets and the Americans together officially, finally. And that was all him. That just showed the power of the New York Times brand and his stature. And the same time he was doing this, he was deliberately covering up Stalin's genocide famine in Ukraine that deliberately starved to death millions of Ukrainians, and a genocide that remained covered up for generations. And so I knew who this guy was as a kid, because everybody in the Ukrainian community knew about this famine. Everybody suffered the trauma of it. And it was even a greater trauma that the outside world outside of Ukraine and communities not directly impacted just didn't know about it. It further victimized the victims. So this feeling of like gaslighting, where it's just people just don't know about this genocide, and it doesn't make it feel real. And of course, in academia for generations, Ukraine was being taught through a Russian lens. And so people just didn't understand how bad it actually was there.
Right.
And there are all sorts of excuses for the famine and justifications. Oh, the Soviets are doing the best they can. But no, it was deliberate genocide. And it was only until recent years where archives were opened to really officially bring so many academics and experts on board. So yeah, no, this was genocide, including historians at Stanford, at Yale, and other places. And Tim Snyder, for instance, of Yale University, he's been instrumental in doing a lot of great research and exposure of the famine in his book Bloodlands and other books. But I began all my research before Ukraine's own history was even decolonized. So I had to do a lot of travel and going to Ukraine and other places. Mm-hmm. And to sort of make this whole story exciting for a Western audience, I stumbled upon information about a real life young kid from nowhere Wales by the name of Gareth Jones, mm-hmm. 27 years old, ambitious, like I was at that time, like young, thirsty, looking out at wanting to be part of the world in a meaningful way. And he went off to Moscow looking for a big story to launch his career. And he stumbled upon rumors of the famine and put the pieces together and was able to talk his way into Ukraine, which was closed off to the outside world because people were being deliberately killed inside.
Yeah.
And so, but he managed, he was so charming and spoke Russian fluently from being, from years of school. And he was able to talk his way in and convince the Soviets that he was going to write some, be like a glowing observer for them. And they were thrilled. Here was this Westerner that was going to go back and tell the world how great it was. But really, he played them and snuck off the train and eluded his secret Soviet police escort and stumbled upon ghost village after ghost village. So the people had just been abducted because everyone had just been starved by hunger. And he came out and blew the lid off this thing and tried to get the truth out into the world. But big, powerful Walter Duranty of the New York Times was aggressively leading a cover-up and saying, this kid is lying. And he wrote in the New York Times, there is no famine. And so this kid's career, you know, Gareth Jones, he suffered. He had to go back to Wales. He had to, you know, get a job, a newspaper job covering local arts and crafts.
Ugh.
And when he went out on another research trip, finally, to kind of get his career going again, he fell in with some men that research suggests were connected to the Soviet secret police. And they ended up getting kidnapped by bandits, and everyone survived but him. And he was left behind and murdered.
Ugh.
And yeah. And so the research that has come out has shown that the last people that he fell in with, these guys, they all had Soviet secret police connections. And one former KGB agent on record in a great documentary by the BBC said that just the Kremlin creates plausible deniability.
Yep.
And so it's that they created the conditions in order for him to be murdered. So they get, you know, punish him, get rid of him. And so he wouldn't be a threat again. And it's the long arm of the Kremlin. It gets you.
Yeah.
And so that's the whole story. But and I know I'm talking your ear off. But the whole story, like, you know, it was such a sort of depressing tale because the big, bad, corrupt Walter Duranty of the New York Times wins. The same year he's awarded the Pulitzer Prize, the conditions of the famine, the Soviets are engineering this famine. So the same year he wins the Pulitzer Prize, he doesn't get it for being honest about what's really going on over there.
Mm-hmm.
He gets it for, it's like access journalism that he gets, you know. And so he wins ultimately. Like he suppresses the truth, and this young hero gets forgotten and buried. And so I really needed some inspiration for myself to keep going on such a tragic story. So I turned to George Orwell and I read Animal Farm. And in the preface to Animal Farm, there was a story on how Orwell struggled for years to get Animal Farm out into the world. No one wanted it because it was such a sharp critique against Stalinism, our great World War II hero. So he fought to get that book published. And somehow, miraculously, after it got published, a copy ended up in the hands of Ukrainian refugees stranded in World War II who understand immediately the book's profound significance. And they hunted down Orwell's home address in London and worked with him to translate Animal Farm into Ukrainian and gave out thousands of copies in the refugee camp. And so I was like, this story is amazing. Like Stalin's own victims fight back through art with Orwell and get the truth out. They tell their own story that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put them into the screenplay and I put Orwell into the screenplay, and he serves this Greek chorus of showing young Gareth fighting to get the truth out, the words of Animal Farm, you know, narrating Gareth's journey.
Wow.
And after I did all that, still nobody wanted my screenplay. Like producers were like, oh, this is fascinating, but you know, it's a little too dark.
Yeah.
But, and so what happened was I ended up, you know, catching up with my aunt and uncle in their farmhouse in the Catskills, telling them, you know, everything I just told you, what I've been up to, this whole, really, really unrealistic screenplay project.
Mm-hmm.
And my uncle looks at me and goes, oh, that's interesting. You know, I have a copy of that Animal Farm. I picked it up in the refugee camp when I was a kid.
Oh my God.
And my aunt gets up from the table and comes back with this like tattered little book that I'd seen only in my research and gives it to me.
Wow.
And that for me was the sign to keep going. And I did. And shortly after that, a production company picked it up in Europe, and I would, you know, and with time the film got made.
Yeah.
And it got made with the most incredible team of people that were like spiritually driven to make this film. Our director, Agnieszka Holland, 3-time Academy Award nominee. She directed The Secret Garden, Europa, Europa, the story of a young Jewish boy who hides in Hitler's youth for survival. She's directed dozens of films and television like The Wire, House of Cards, The Affair. And she was, you know, people told me, like when I pitched her the script, people told me like, you know, don't give your hopes up. She just rejected the greatest script I ever read. But Agnieszka right away said yes to my script because she grew up in Soviet-occupied Poland. Both her mom and dad were journalists, and her father's official cause of death was suicide while under police interrogation.
Ugh. Good God. Well,
so for her, yeah. So for her, the story was just as personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For both of you. And then I imagine the events of 2014 must have escalated interest in your work at that point, right? Like with the invasion into Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea. I mean, everything changed, especially in terms of U.S.-Russia relationships, but also in terms of suddenly Ukraine is back on the map again in terms of, you know, its relationship with Moscow and so on. Did you get a lot of phone calls at that point? Is that kind of what helped to jumpstart the screenplay and get it made?
Yeah, well, I with all that said, I feel like I haven't had a day off since November 2013. I feel like my whole nervous system is just plugged into world events having to do with Ukraine and Russia and the U.S. now. And a lot of, like, you know, witnessing the Ukrainian revolution up close, following that so closely on live streams and going to Kiev, you know, straight after. Mm-hmm. And all of it. Like, it's been surreal to watch Ukraine be a laboratory of Kremlin aggression and then have it come to the U.S. Like, the war came here to us. And I've always said that the election of Donald Trump feels like the bigger, badder sequel to Ukraine's revolution.
Yeah, Yanukovych. Yeah, and with the common denominator being Paul Manafort.
Yeah, exactly right. The smoking gun of Russiagate, and during those years, especially when the revolution started, I found myself joining complete strangers on Twitter, social media, battling bots. It was like this first wave of Kremlin bots who were very rough and like kamikaze bots. They would just like spiral into you, hurling all sorts of broken English insults. I was full on called like a Jewish Nazi whore, really, really weird stuff. You know, like the first generation of bots were just so crude, and they were designed to terrorize you and intimidate you to get off Twitter. And we would just make fun of them and bat them around because they were just so over the top ridiculous. But we saw that this was an orchestrated disinformation campaign. And we saw, and even when all this research came out about the whole bot operation, I looked at the accounts that I blocked from this time, and they were like the big notes in the Kremlin's information war. I had these guys blocked for years. and so it was just a surreal feeling for years of being on the front lines of this Kremlin information war 2.0, because of course my film itself, Mr. Jones, looks at a media case study of corruption, how complicit access journalism is in aiding regime corruption and looking at what a Kremlin media cover-up looks like. So my film is like the historical case study of what we've experienced in 2014 to present day with the Kremlin disinformation warfare.
Yep.
So I was like on like the front lines of it 2.0. And it was just for years, we were just all of us who were journalists and activists who were banded together through this. We were like, is anybody going to do anything? Mm-hmm. Like, where's the Obama administration and all this?
Yeah.
And it was just, has it really fallen to us to do rapid fire fact checking of all this propaganda that's being spewed out there? And you would see it happening in real time. Like, for instance, there was this huge debate being waged in Western media over whether or not Ukraine's uprising, its popular uprising, was a neo-Nazi uprising. And you saw incredible journalists, incredible news outlets spreading this. And without question, like, Ukraine, like every single country in Europe, has a far-right problem that's very serious and needs to be taken seriously, without question.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, one could arguably say that Ukraine's far-right problem is nothing compared to America's far-right problem.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Right.
I would rather have Ukraine's far-right problem than America's far-right problem, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You always want to take the far right seriously, so I hate to use this word, but it felt very overblown compared to the reality on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're, even Jewish leaders and community Jewish activists inside Ukraine were issuing statements saying, please stop spreading the Kremlin narrative that this is a neo-Nazi uprising. And when it's really just a diverse group of people who are pushed to the breaking point, and the corruption here is unimaginable. What Yanukovych, Manafort's client, has done to Ukraine is unimaginable. Mm-hmm. So if people are risking their lives and willing to die, imagine how bad it is there for them to be pushed to that point. Like, so stop just labeling us all neo-Nazis.
Yeah.
And so I was busy like writing all these pieces and all these things and fact-checking the Kremlin in real time. And through that, I got to know Tim Snyder, the historian who wrote of Yale University, who I mentioned earlier. He wrote also On Tyranny, a great book on resistance lessons against authoritarianism from 20th century. Mm-hmm. He wrote The Road to Unfreedom to understand also how we got here. And so Tim and I were like fact checking this stuff in real time, and he would send me his articles and I'd blast them out there. And so when Tim did an event with Agnieszka Holland, my director, I right away was like, I need her email address right now. I pitched her directly, and I got on a call with her, and I was so terrified. Mm-hmm. And she ended up being a wonderful human being and incredibly generous and gracious, and gave me total freedom and a total lioness. And I learned so much from working with her.
Yeah.
And just the script process was phenomenal, because she would say things to me from her own life growing up in under Soviet oppression. She would say, you know, when we were protesting the Russian tanks in Prague in 1968, the soldiers were really confused. They had no idea what they were doing there. So make your soldier here in this village a little bit confused. So much of her life went in coloring the script itself. And that was just, you know, heartbreaking and just such powerful stories from her throughout this whole process of making the film.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's fascinating too with not only your own experiences, your family's experiences, but also this director's experiences. There's something that comes along with witnessing something firsthand, to actually seeing it in front of your face. And this actually goes to the troll attacks that you were, and so many of us were subject to for many, many years. And you know, we saw it all happening. And then we're being told, and this goes right to the gaslighting, no, what you saw, what you witnessed happening every day really didn't happen. It was nothing. It was a hoax. It was something else. The attack, the social media prong of the Russian active measures were so obvious, weren't they?
No, beyond. It was surreal. It was such a surreal experience, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And to your point, I actually just the other night, because I have the podcast with Sarah Kendzior, Gaslit Nation,
yes,
which exists for this sole purpose, is to help people come together as a community and say, yes, no, this is really happening. You know, believe your eyes, believe your ears. The facts are still the facts. And because what we have is just, you know, unfortunately, I hate to say it, but Americans are relatively soft compared to the realities of kleptocracy that flourish in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. So we weren't prepared for this. We believed that our institutions would save us, not realizing how quickly our institutions can actually be dismantled. And corporate media, as we've seen with decades of layoffs, with newsrooms shrinking and local newspapers disappearing and local TV stations being taken over, what you're seeing is that those who remain in these coveted newsroom jobs we looked at the data. We looked at the data and presented the data, pulled together different sources on Gaslit Nation, presented the data. And what it points to is those who are left standing in the major influential newsrooms across America tend to predominantly be white men and women, with very little people of color, communities of color. And it's the communities of color right now who have always felt the realities of a police state, because that's what America is like for them.
Yeah.
And they understand that they take the tremors of a police state very seriously. Whereas people who are white and tend to come from privilege, like and nepotism, like many who are influential in mainstream media today and corporate media, they will not be impacted by these destructive policies coming out of this White House. And for them, it's more entertaining. And even though it is an existential threat to them, they brush it off because for them it's business as usual. And a lot of these guys are, of course, profiting. Like, as we've seen, like Les Moonves, before he's pushed out of CBS, rightfully so, he was saying, you know, Trump is great for us. Jeff Zucker, Trump is great for us. That's why he turned the Trump campaign into CNN's reality show with his Kardashian candidate. And so, yeah, so what's basically has happened is that, you know, we have to remind ourselves that corporate media more than ever will not protect us, especially not this moment we're in now. So independent media, like your show and mine, they become a lot more important and urgent. And, you know, fact-checking and standing by the facts and just having an open, humble attitude of being in service of the facts and correcting yourself when you're wrong and just having an agenda that serves the facts and just unites people around this notion of we just want to feel safe. We're tired of living in a country where institutions are in constant decline. Mm-hmm. We're tired of living in a country where policies are constantly being passed that further worsen the growing income inequality gap, which hasn't been this bad since the Gilded Age. And so, you know, then we have global warming that's coming for us.
Yep.
And then we have, oh dear God, the AI Pandora box of artificial intelligence and what that's going to do for the whole propaganda information war space. And then don't get me started on the robot soldiers.
So it's sort of like,
I feel like we're at this moment where it's like quaint. Like this, I know everybody feels despair and they want to be in a fetal position, but looking back now, this whole time will feel quaint.
Yeah.
Like Tolkien writing his, you know, the Lord of the Rings, where he was sort of, that was a big, those books were, of course, looking at the environmental, travesty being engineered by the Industrial Revolution that was ongoing and all of it. Instead of looking out of his window and bemoaning all that. But we look back on that period and go, how quaint that was. How much time we had back then. But he was writing out of a sense of despair and warning and foreboding. So we are really right now, like if you think bots are bad, if you think these social media, fake Christian moms with MAGA hats and their Twitter profiles, like tweeting in broken English are bad. Mm-hmm. Wait until the AI comes and really gets going and all of it. So this is actually probably one of the last quaint periods we might ever know. And so I think it's imperative for all of us to stay engaged and to rely on communities now more than ever, especially for verified and independent information that's compassion-driven, fact-driven, and just stay engaged and find ways to stay engaged locally in your community and to effect change and just simply do not give up. And if you want a silver bullet for how to fight for change locally, look to groups like Future Now and Every District, two great organizations looking to turn states blue, create a whole progressive way from the very bottom up to the top. Because with Trump packing the courts, with McConnell packing our courts, with this absolute disregard for checks and balances and living above the law, what we need right now is, as a buffer to protect ourselves, is to turn every single state in this union and strengthen them into progressive paradises that will stand up against the Trump regime and the GOP terrorist organization backed by the GOP, by the NRA terrorist organization.
Yeah. And, you know, Andre, it feels like the urgency about the dangers that we're witnessing going on, the dangers of the Trump administration, the dangers of Trumpism, the dangers of Russia infiltrating so significantly into our electoral systems that I actually believe, and I'd love to hear where you are on this, that those Russian active measures actually did swing the election because they changed minds before anyone stepped into a single voting booth. And so I feel like the danger of that cannot be overstated, right?
Oh, without question. And people, what this is, cynically speaking, what the Kremlin attack on our democracy in 2016 was a great underdog story. You know, Putin was isolated, the sanctions were working, and the Obama administration had a calculation that if you squeeze Putin's inner circle and with sanctions, that it will cause a revolt against Putin, which is ridiculous. That's not how culturally that they work. They double down and they fight back harder and they unite and they treat you like the enemy and they are willing to fight in dirty ways that you're not willing to fight with. Like they full on fired up RT. Like the editor in chief of RT has said that she sees what she does as an extension of Russia's Ministry of Defense. Mm-hmm. And even in 2017, the Minister of Defense for Russia gave a speech, I believe it's to the Russian parliament, saying that that the Kremlin is learning on how sophisticated is how to make their propaganda even more sophisticated. So they're what this is it's asymmetrical warfare. Mm-hmm. It's cheap. It's invading a country without having to the expense of sending over a bunch of
God, thank you so much for saying that because it was
reality though. But that is the reality of it. Is the reality. That is the strategy. And, you know, it is a David and Goliath story. And whether we like to admit it or not, but what the Kremlin achieved in 2016 is going to be remembered as a great military operation, a great underdog success story, because we are by far the most powerful military in the world. And there's no sense in feeding tens of billions of dollars to the military industrial complex to buy more machinery, to buy all these heavy planes and all these big massive ships, when the Russians can just create, when any enemy at all can create an influence campaign to sow discord and confusion and to make the whole information landscape exhaust you, where you just give up and you want to pull away. And on top of that, stirring chaos with they hacked every single one of our states. It turned out, we finally found out that every single state was hacked and their election systems were hacked. Every single one. We just found this out. It was just confirmed. And of course, anybody that knows the Kremlin's tactics, they're scorched earth.
Yeah.
Anybody that follows the Kremlin will tell you, of course they went into every single state. Why would they just go into 10 or half? They went into every single state because they were looking to succeed. It was a big gamble on their part, because they didn't know if they would succeed, and if Hillary would have won, they would have been dead. They would have had way more sanctions. Hillary and Merkel would have united in a strong show of solidarity against Kremlin aggression. We'd have a much different world than we're living in today. So they took a very big gamble here, and it paid off amazingly, because the American public and the American media was simply not prepared for asymmetrical warfare of this type.
And it seems like without the visual spectacle of buildings collapsing, it seems like absent that, I don't think there are enough of us who really understand that it's even going on. There are, in fact, millions of people, sadly, both on the Trump side and on the left, who are just actively blowing holes in all of this, like actively trying to figure out some sort of way to push their denialism into the mainstream and to try to derail the clear view of, as you said, an invasion of the United States, in which not only were there Russians engaged in this, but we had millions of unwitting accomplices, unwitting Confederates in that effort, people who bought all of the social media misinformation and memes and everything that happened in order to change their votes. And so the scope of all of this is almost blinding, isn't it? I mean, it's so vast that it's almost difficult to see unless you really start to look at the granular detail, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's the advantage, right? It's the plausible deniability.
Yeah.
And it's those who have experience with studying the active measures and seeing it play out in countries like Ukraine and the Baltic states who are utterly not surprised by any of this and see it clear as day. And it's those amateurs who are just sort of throwing themselves into it as sort of trolls on the left or trolls on the right, who are making noise about something that they have very little understanding of. And in fact, I see them as anti-vaxxers. It's like, you know, it's like if you look at the anti-vaxxer movement, like everybody is alarmed and paranoid over autism and that vaccines will give you autism. And so let's stop taking vaccines because we're a bunch of idiots. They don't understand that it's like a total, just like with the Russiagate skeptics, they have a total and utter disregard for history. Because if you understood the history, for instance, behind autism, what you will realize then is that the reason why we suddenly hear about autism all the time isn't simply because there's an autism epidemic. That's not it. It's because the research has finally caught up to understanding what autism is. And therefore, there's been greater awareness and greater resources for families living with autism and so forth.
Yeah.
And it's not like our modern lifestyle has produced all this you know, has produced autism out in the greater population. It's that it's because the science has finally caught up mm-hmm. and is finally able to treat autism the right way and build a proper awareness around it to support the families living with it. And instead of understanding that history behind it, the history behind the research and the struggle to get to this point, which is a great point for people that need the support and the research, of course, instead of understanding the historical perspective, they become paranoid and they and dismissive and mm-hmm. shallow and absolutely reactive in their thinking. And that's what's bred, and they fall into propaganda easily and simplistic explanations.
Yeah.
And that's what bred the anti-vaxxer movement. And I see that from studying these Russiagate skeptics. It's the same simplistic, shallow thinking that reveals an utter disregard for history. For history, because active measures are active measures, just like they were under Stalin in the 30s to where they are today. It's the same playbook.
Yeah.
Authoritarianism doesn't change. It's the same playbook. It's just the technology they have to suppress it. That's the only big unknown variable that changes. But yeah, no, this was one of the great worst, if not the worst, terrorist attack against the United States. Mm-hmm. And I say possibly the worst simply because, you know, yes, 9/11 was horrible and the thousands of lives lost. But what's happened with this terrorist attack is that it's opened the floodgate to actual authoritarianism to grow and take hold in the U.S. And we don't know how long this could possibly last or how mm-hmm. how horrible it could get. And we've already seen through Trump a dismantling of the Western alliance. I mean, he's aligning himself with absolute autocrats and legitimizing. He's done more to legitimize Kim Jong-un, the mass murderer dictator of North Korea, which is a cult of a country, an abusive cult of a country. He's done more to legitimize him than Dennis Rodman had. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's like that's the president of the United States. You know, so it's like this. So the ripple effect, the damage that this Trump regime is going to do, and God forbid Ivanka and Don Jr., because they both have political ambitions, if they're not held accountable for their participation in Russiagate, you know, Don Jr. was, of course, in that Trump Tower June 2016 meeting, mm-hmm. trying to get that big quid pro quo deal with the Kremlin, trying to get Durham and Hillary Clinton in exchange for confirmed campaign help, all of that. Ivanka led the transition team with Pence. Michael Flynn, so the transition team, told him to call the Russians to calm them down when Obama passed sanctions on the way out. Mm-hmm. Ivanka, Trump, and Jared were basically the center nerve system of the campaign and running things. So anything happening, they were aware of it because information is power, of course, in politics. So of course Ivanka has her hands all over this. Mm-hmm. So if Ivanka and Don Jr. aren't held accountable, and then we're stuck with them having political careers for them to further their corruption and destruction on our democracy and our standing in the world. And unfortunately, the corporate media that likes palace intrigue stories is going to, you know, be all over this in a way that's very shallow and damaging for our democracy.
Mm-hmm. What was your reaction when the Barr memo dropped and it became clear that there were going to be no further indictments, at least for now, it seems, coming out of the special counsel's office? What did you make of all of that? Because I think we were all to some level in shock by what we were seeing, and only because, again, the Barr memo itself, going back to gaslighting, the Barr memo itself felt like gaslighting. No, nothing to see here. Go back to your homes. Go back to your homes.
Well, yeah, I think it was clear. I one benefit I have from being so focused on Ukraine since 2013 and just seeing such a lack of will to address Kremlin active measures and propaganda all these years under the Obama administration, and was just the sense of, is anybody going to do anything? Why isn't anybody stopping this?
Yeah.
And I know from somebody that served in the Department of Defense for Obama that the Middle East and, of course, fighting ISIS, that was the priority. And unfortunately, you know, in my opinion, Obama spread himself way too thin by then trying to do the Iran deal and prioritizing that and opening up Cuba, when meanwhile the Kremlin is already, you know, creating this whole bot campaign and Maria Butina is activated and you know, pollinating her NRA contacts and GOP contacts. And the Kremlin's gunning for you, man. Like, you've got to sort of watch the Kremlin, which has, you know, invaded Georgia and invaded Ukraine and is using cheap asymmetrical warfare to try to destabilize democracies around the world.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to put your, you kind of have to push some things off your plate and put your focus there. So for me, I've sort of been living with this sense of lack for so long of any sort of meaningful and substantial, you know, any meaningful U.S. leadership to really fight back in a way that would be effective. Mm-hmm. And that includes the FBI, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, James Comey, for whatever reason, took the head of the Russian mafia off the FBI 10 most wanted list in December 2015. And a year later, Trump was president. And that's significant because Trump's money, his connections, he and his family, they were embedded in Russian oligarch money. They were embedded with Russian mafia connections.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Russian mafia gambling den, one floor beneath Trump's own personal floor inside Trump Tower.
Yep.
That, you know, it's like they had a long history going back 30 years. So Trump's not just a Kremlin asset. He's a Russian mafia asset.
Mm-hmm.
Even Don Jr. and Eric said that their businesses, the Trump businesses, depend on Russian money. They were laundromats. Trump properties were laundromats for oligarchs and trying to, you know, park their money abroad and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, James Comey taking the head of the Russian mafia off the 10 most wanted list, the FBI, in 2015, and then like one of their assets gets elected president,
mm-hmm.
and then Paul Manafort, he was under investigation. In connection to Yanukovych being under investigation for the tens of billions he stole from Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI was called in by Ukraine in early 2014 to help hunt down the tens of billions Yanukovych stole. And obviously, being in close contact with Yanukovych, Manafort would certainly be on their radar. So here you have Manafort, who is like a close ally, the hands of the king, of Yanukovych, a guy the FBI is already investigating, who's living in exile under Kremlin protection inside Russia. You have him suddenly running Donald Trump's campaign for president. Donald Trump with all like 30 years of Russian money, Russian mafia connections.
Yeah.
Where was the FBI during all this? And even Robert Mueller, if you Google this, when Robert Mueller was FBI director, if you Google a speech he gave in 2011, the Iron Triangle speech,
mm-hmm.
he gives an entire speech describing how the mafia of today is not a bunch of guys in Brooklyn in a pizza parlor like breaking kneecaps. The mafia of today are political operatives like Paul Manafort making blood money in developing democracies, kleptocracies like Ukraine. It's fancy accounting firms and fancy law firms that hide this money, that park it abroad. And he gives the head of the Russian mafia, Semion Mogilevich, as the classic example of what the mafia looks like in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And he promises in this speech in 2011 that Semion Mogilevich will remain on the FBI's 10 most wanted list until he is caught. That's what Robert Mueller promises us. And then for whatever reason, a few years later under James Comey, he gets taken off.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like I've seen institutional failure for years now. And so the Barr memo was, the Barr report, as I call it, was very much, you know, part of that institutional failure.
Yeah.
And cynically so. You had, he's the Iran-Contra cleanup guy. He's doing what he was hired to do. He got that job through a memo, unfortunately, from a memo saying, you know, basically clearing the president of his innocence. William Barr got his job as Attorney General by already clearing the President of the United States of his innocence by saying he did not believe in obstruction of justice.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of it was orchestrated to protect the president and his family so they can continue living above the law and stay in power God knows how
long.
Yeah. And one thing you can always count on with this president is the Trump clan is that they see us coming.
Mm-hmm.
Like any credible pollster could have told you a blue wave was coming. If you looked at the elections in Washington State, New Jersey, and Virginia in 2017, especially Virginia, that was a blue wave. That was clear. If you look at what John Ossoff pulled off in Virginia, and Newt Gingrich is really red district, even though that went to a runoff race, it was still significant that liberal hipster, you know, young John Ossoff got into a runoff race in a deeply red congressional district. So any credible pollster could tell you the blue wave was coming for Donald Trump. in the midterms. And so what did Donald Trump do? He got Matthew Whitaker, a shameless loyalist, like his brass knuckles in place to be acting AG to protect him. He got that ready. And then when Matthew Whitaker proved too on the nose, then he had to replace him with somebody more credible, of course, which is William Barr. And William Barr is just a fancy, polished version of Matthew Whitaker, but he's carrying out the same function of protecting the president at the cost of our democracy and sovereignty. So one thing we have to count on with this Trump family is that they've always lived above the law. I mean, look at how they've in downturns, they were collecting Russian oligarch money and building their golf courses that way. So they know how to get out of this. They know how to bob and weave. And so they always see us coming.
Yeah.
And so we always have to anticipate that from them.
And, you know, it's interesting because we had this debate during the George W. Bush years in Blogosphere 1.0, which is the often or seeming conflict between the public persona of the bungling idiot president and the private persona. In fact, you know what? Saturday Night Live did a thing like this with Ronald Reagan, where it was, believe it or not, I think it was Phil Hartman playing Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan would come out into the Oval Office, meet with Boy Scouts, and be affable and goofy, and then the Boy Scouts would leave, and he'd say, "All right, back to work," and he'd have the maps, and we're getting ready to do things here, and so there was like this dichotomy between the public Reagan and the private calculating Reagan, and I'm wondering, is there someone behind the scenes? Is there sort of a Rasputin behind the scenes with Trump? And, you know, it could be Vladimir Putin himself. But, you know, I mean, in terms of people saying to Trump, OK, here's what here's how the strategy plays out. Here's what you need to do next. Someone moving his chess pieces for him rather than him doing it himself. How involved do you think Trump actually is in thinking through and gaming out Matt Whitaker, and then we'll bring in someone who's more serious like Bill Barr? Is that really him, or is that, I don't know, Stephen Miller, someone behind the scenes telling him what to do?
No, I think that is him. Think he's used to being the boss, and living in New York City, you just Trump could have spared himself running for president. He would have remained one of those, ridiculous mascots of New York City and probably had an easier life.
Right.
But living in New York City, you can come across people who have worked for him and met him. And I have, and the stories I've always heard over the years have always been simply that he's the boss. He is the boss. He is the boss by pure design because, it's his organizations, it's his companies, and he likes being the boss. I mean, who doesn't like being the boss? In Trump's case, though, being the boss is an extension of his narcissism. He calls the shots. He belittles people. He humiliates people. He brags about his power, his wealth, his access. Mm-hmm. He moves on them like a bitch when it comes to attractive women that he wants. He behaves like a character out of Goodfellas. It's like attracts like. Birds of a feather flock together. And it's sort of like, the Russian people today, we talk about extreme income inequality, they're suffering they're suffering from kleptocracy and corruption, taking great risks to practice journalism and activism. And really one of the horrible plagues of Putin's Russia is this nouveau riche materialism of the class that made it, this whole oligarch class and all those who sort of enriched themselves through it. It's a rampant soulless materialism that's straight out of Trump. It's like they're culturally aligned. And so it's a Trump Tower Moscow with an Ivanka Trump branded spa and a free penthouse for Putin. That is so on brand for the oligarch ruling class of Russia and of the Trump regime. It's like they're so culturally aligned in their materialistic values. And so Trump's right at home in that world of living like a king and living above the law and calling the shots and humiliating people and having nicknames for people. That is who it is. And I think in terms of who can survive in that petri dish of sinister bacteria is, of course, Stephen Miller, who is tough and immature and engage and has the basest authoritarian instincts, just like the boss, Trump. So those two are great together. So it's like whoever is left standing in that environment is very much culturally aligned with the boss himself. And that is, of course, his mini-me Ivanka, who's her father wrapped up in a prettier package. It's chronic liar Pence, who just speaks when spoken to and acts completely obedient with some weird sort of evangelical level of obedience towards this God figure of Trump. And then, you know, you have Jared Kushner, who has his own protection being the son-in-law and can operate in that world. And, you know, as long as he keeps the daughter happy. So, those are the main players. And anybody that had any big impact, like Bannon, Bannon didn't get shoved out because Heather Heyer was murdered because of the culture of hate and violence that Bannon and Trump created. Bannon got pushed out because he was taking too much of the spotlight from Trump.
Yeah.
And Ivanka and Jared wanted to win the power struggle over him finally. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, so whoever survives there, it's like whoever's last man standing, it's, you have to be aligned with the boss himself. You have to be culturally and just on the same page and inside the little clique of the boss himself. And that boss is Trump.
Yep, absolutely. And speaking of him, in terms of strategy and figuring out what to do next, what steps to take next, I have this ongoing theme, which is that Donald Trump always makes things worse for Donald Trump. Every decision he makes only worsens his peril, doesn't necessarily pull him out of it. But, you know, along those lines, there's this ongoing discussion, and certainly by tomorrow, this time, it'll be moot anyway. But, you know, this discussion of whether or not Donald Trump is going to exert executive privilege over parts of this report before it comes out, the Mueller report. And it appears as if, at this point, that he doesn't have any intention of doing that, or at least not in terms of executive privilege over gigantic sections, or even withholding the whole report under executive privilege. Why do you think it appears as if he's decided to just let the report drop and hope the redactions cover his ass enough and then play spin on whatever else is remaining? Why do you think he's taking that risk?
Well, I think that he... I think a couple things. I think they have been very, very good at, you know, people have to acknowledge history here, recent history, and not forget that Donald Trump and his far-right cesspool propaganda machine, Fox News included, and all these crazy obscure blogs and bots and all of it, they have been extremely effective at targeting and harassing specific members of the FBI, like Lisa Page, Bruce Ohr, and others who are specialized in organized crime and see him for what he is and see the Kremlin active measures for what they are and understand and are trained to understand and go after the iron triangles that Mueller warned us about in his 2011 speech about the mafia in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. So that was a relentless campaign of harassing and breaking down and targeting the men and women that in law enforcement, the FBI, who were tasked with investigating this Russian mafia asset in the White House. So that's one thing. And so they've been very, very, very good at obstructing justice out in the open. And we've just become numb to it. And it's become normalized as chaos coming out of the White House. And we lose track of it. So it's one thing is to remind us that this has been active measures carried out by the President of the United States out in the open against his enemies and a purging of the FBI. And that includes, of course, firing Andrew McCabe, the day before he was set to retire, you know, right before he was set to retire and collect his pension. Those harassment techniques, like that vile harassment by arguably the most powerful person in the world, that creates a very dangerous psychological terror over anybody in any position to stop this and slow it down. You know, people fall in line. This is a purge. This is what a purge looks like. It's not tanks rolling into Paris. It's not the Nazis marching into Paris. You're not going to see that in, you know, you're not going to see that in the National Mall in Washington, D.C. this is what authoritarianism looks like. Mm. It's like they do punitive audits and all types of punitive searches of anybody that all types of harassment and intimidation, and they put their laser propaganda bomb on you, and that's incredibly intimidating, especially all the everything that comes with it. And so that's one thing. Mm-hmm. And the other is that anybody left standing to hold them accountable, like Rod Rosenstein, well, he's somebody who's considered a survivor, which means he keeps his head down, which means he's a good soldier, a good boy to whoever's in charge. And so he lends no credibility here. He's just like a blank canvas. And he got filled by A.G. Barr, who is the steamroller, who's coming in, the fixer to take care of business. And, his allegiance is to protecting the far-right conservative movement in America, as he did with Reagan's administration back with Iran-Contra. And so with all those indictments, all those people that got off because of him. So all of this has been like a really clever orchestrated cover-up from their perspective. We put up a very valiant fight. We fought very hard with the free press, with investigative journalists, with activists, with marches. And they just had much more powerful means at their disposal, and they broke so many norms in order to crush their opponents and to get into a position where they could feel relatively safe, where it just doesn't matter anymore, and it's going to become old news.
And, my concern, Andrea, is moving forward, he can't be allowed to get away with it. I always play this clip from Breaking Bad with Jesse Pinkman screaming, he can't keep getting away with it. But I think the idea of impeachment, which you and Sarah have spent a lot of time talking about on Gaslit Nation, is so crucial right now. If for no other reason, but to send a signal to future despots that at least the Democratic Party is not going to allow anyone else to get away with what Trump has gotten away with. And I think that's why impeachment has to be on the table. Impeachment has to be pursued. In fact, I believe that articles of impeachment should be voted on the House floor and ultimately passed if everything goes, according to the way it ought to go. Then again, we are in a weird timeline. So why do you think people are still dragging their feet? I mean, specifically Democrats on this idea of seriously holding this guy accountable.
Yeah, no, I agree with you fully. And I think, it is the constitutional duty to impeach a president like this. It's a political decision not to impeach a president like this.
Yeah.
So the Constitution demands impeachment. And not to do it is some political calculation, which quite frankly, simply does not make sense under examination.
Yeah.
So for one thing, I hear often that, it's going to really set us back in 2020. Well, first of all, no one knows anything anymore. It's like there is no more normal. So anybody, any campaigners or campaign consultants making their money today, they do not know what landscape exists out there. And that is from the historian Joyce Kearns Goodwin, right? Was that, I'm getting her name right, the presidential historian?
Yeah.
She was on MSNBC pleading with the media saying, look, I'm a presidential historian. None of this is normal anymore. So your old rule book of trying to understand what's out there doesn't exist anymore. It's gone.
My God.
He flipped it up. Yeah.
That's so salient. I swear to God, because, we all do that. We all look to the past and say, how can we apply what's happened in the past to what's happening now? And I discovered after the 2016 election, the next day, November 9th or whatever it was, I'm going, you know what? Maybe I was looking at this through the wrong prism. I was looking at this through a different prism, and it no longer applies anymore, right?
Exactly. So no one knows anything anymore. So when people press you on 2020 and it's going to hurt our chances, ask them specifically what they're talking about, because they simply have no idea. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, he will always have that hardcore 3% because they are the ones who are fighting a culture war of hate, of ideology. They are the ideological heirs of Hitler. There's no convincing them. There's no engaging with them. You cannot negotiate with terrorists and people who just want to destroy you. It's futile. And so instead, you have to look to the fact that even with the Kremlin's active measures, even with the media and the American public being so off guard of what was happening in 2016, with this coalition of corruption, the NRA, the Trump family, the Kremlin itself and their cutouts, all of it influencing this vote directly on the ground with social media bots, all of it with dark money, all of it. Even with that huge coalition of corruption in place, oh, God help me, Cambridge Analytica with military propaganda, all driving out authoritarian voters, huge operation in place that was put in place over years of planning and coalition building. Mm-hmm. And so with all of that, still, 3 million more people voted against him. 3 million more Americans.
Yep.
So we have the numbers on our side. And we are in this hot mess because of 70,000 people across three swing states. And so don't tell me that 2020, like anyone knows, you know, so it's sort of like we've got the numbers already on our side, mm-hmm. just based on what the little that we knew back then. We have the numbers. Now that so much has come out, now that so many more people have been politicized, you have to trust the American people. The American people are smarter than the establishment in Washington. The American people are smarter than corporate media. Mm. For instance, when the Barr memo came out and you had the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post saying that the Mueller report exonerates Trump, which simply isn't true because no one saw the Mueller report. Everyone was just basing this on the Iran-Contra cleanup guy's word. And lo and behold, FBI agents took it upon themselves to actually leak to try to set the record straight days later. But still, when the Barr memo came out, which was clear gaslighting for anybody paying attention, the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, still had the audacity and the lack of common sense and decency to publish on their front page, the Mueller report exonerates Trump. That's disastrous. But then you poll Americans, the Democrats, independents, and Republicans, and overwhelmingly, they all said, bullshit, we want to see the Mueller report. We want to see their Mueller report.
Yeah.
So we're living in extreme times, and you can trust that today Americans are smarter than the establishment in Washington. Americans are smarter than corporate media. Why? Because these times are dangerous, and everybody has something or someone they want to protect that they love in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of us feel unsafe right now, whether you're white and privileged or in a community of color, all of us feel unsafe right now.
Yeah.
And so when you feel unsafe, common sense kicks in and you read through the newspeak and you're like, no, give me the facts, give me the Mueller report, because I want to know whether my family and I are safe. I want to know how bad this is. And so right now we have to really base our calculation that authoritarianism isn't coming, it is here. And Americans are smart enough to see that none of this is normal and that all of this is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a huge factor.
Yeah.
And the other factor is, Trump has built his entire life around building monuments to himself. He was going to sell out his country over Trump Tower Moscow, the tallest building in Europe.
Yeah.
He donated money to create Donald J. Trump State Park in New York State. He built his Mar-a-Lago down the beach from the historic Gilded Age palace of the Breakers. You know, so he builds monuments to himself. He even says something ridiculous about Mount Vernon should have had Washington's name on it. So that's how they remember you.
So Trump is
Ozymandias from that Percy Shelley poem. Like, he builds monuments to himself. And so the best way to hurt someone like that is to brand him by voting for impeachment. So he has to wear the stink of impeachment, he and his family.
Yep.
So the Democrats in the House are holding all the cards right now to kick him where it hurts, and that is by making him wear the big orange letter of impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to just drive him nuts, because that's how he operates. That's how he's wired. And on top of that, if you simply don't impeach him, he will be pointing to that for the rest of his life. Hey, you know, the House had the chance to impeach him, but they didn't.
Yep.
He will be rubbing that in our faces. Ivanka Trump and Don Jr., when they have their own rallies for their own political careers, they'll be rubbing that in our faces.
Yeah.
The House, the Democrats in the House could have impeached us, but there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be gloating and riding that wave for the rest of their political careers. And that's why it's so disastrous that whatever Nancy Pelosi did, whatever deal she struck in private, because, you know, like I said, they see us coming. They see us coming. They put Whitaker in place in time for the blue wave that was coming to protect the president. So they saw impeachment coming. If you recall, there's all these news reports that Trump was obsessed with impeachment. He feared for impeachment. Even though he knew McConnell was going to protect him, McConnell's wife serves in his cabinet. McConnell's just as morally corrupt as he is. McConnell's own state just got a massive, massive aluminum plants built and paid for by one of Putin's top oligarch generals, which is, you know, Oleg Deripaska.
Mm-hmm.
So even though he could totally rely on McConnell, he still feared impeachment because he's that vain and insecure, and so are the people around him. So he saw impeachment coming. So the question is, what did they do to Nancy Pelosi? What deal did they force her into? What did they offer her in order to get her to say that impeachment was off the table and he's not worth it? Because the way Nancy Pelosi handled it was so dismissive. Mm. She said, you know, they wanted me to impeach George W. Bush, and I didn't do that either. And it's like, yeah, and we got Trump. It's like, we're still paying the price for Bush's war that killed hundreds of thousands of civilians and bred ISIS, which we're still fighting. And it's like, it's sort of like, yeah, that war was based on lies. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we wanted impeachment and accountability. And if you don't, you're going to get more Bushes and Trumps. So Nancy Pelosi being so dismissive and all of her points against impeachment falling apart upon closer examination, and just the fact that the Democrats that were polled in the midterms, the majority wanted impeachment. That blue wave came in on the hope and expectation of impeachment. So for her to just, you know, try to do this like Rue Callahan impersonation and just try to get a Twitter meme out of it and just sass her way out of it, it's not going to work because people want to feel safe. People see that none of this is normal and that their lives are in danger. And so it's at the point now where you have to wonder, what was she promised? Mm. Was it the government shutdown? Did she get the government back up because she took impeachment off the table? Was she promised some of her big bills were going to get passed through the Senate by Mitch McConnell if she took impeachment off the table? What was she promised to keep impeachment off the table? That is the question we all need to be asking ourselves now. What did Pelosi get in return for taking impeachment off the table?
Yeah. What is impeach normalization?
Impeach normalization is the title of a podcast that Sarah and I did in response to being gut punched of Pelosi's comments saying that, you know, impeachment was off the table and he's just not worth it. And we were stunned. We were absolutely stunned because we didn't think that out of all the things we have to fight against right now that we'd have to be fighting for impeachment on top of everything else.
Yep.
You'd expect more unity and moral courage and leadership and a true understanding of the gravity of the situation from those who politically have the power that you don't to protect our country. Mm. You know, Pelosi is the third most powerful person in the country. And she was just so dismissive when there's an actual sex trafficking ring that was created because of Stephen Miller's inhumane border policy that's deliberately cruel. So it's sort of like, what do you mean he's not worth it? Look at all the crimes he's committed and all the investigations since he's been in office. And impeachment itself creates an event. It capitalizes on the pageantry of that dictators, wannabe dictators like Trump, can't get enough of. It creates a big national event to bring our country together with televised live impeachment hearings that formalize the process. Like, we know there's other investigations and so forth, but an actual impeachment hearing would be a big event that people would be watching from all parties. It would actually unite our country more than it would divide it in that regard. Mm-hmm. If you look at when Comey testified in Congress, how the ratings shot up and so forth, including, you know, when Michael Cohen testified, those were big days for C-SPAN. So with televised impeachment hearings, that would be such a huge event, and Trump is a sucker for huge events. That would really hit him where it hurts and bring our country together. So what we said in impeach normalization was like all these points. And we're saying that if you don't hold him accountable, what you're doing is you're normalizing this and you're allowing this to be the new normal and to set in. If you don't have accountability, if you don't take stands of moral courage, everything crumbles.
Yep.
And that's what happened in Italy with Berlusconi. That's what happened in Turkey with Erdogan. These were leaders that were buffoons, that were laughed at. And over time, they were so relentless with their corruption and their purging and all of it, that it wore down the society and they became accepted and normalized. And so these new norms set in. I had a friend that lived in Turkey during the start of Erdogan, and she went back in recent years and she was shocked to see friends who were like, so intellectual, so anti-Erdogan and fighting against him, suddenly justifying the way life was there, and that's just the way it is. And that's what happens, is that normalization basically numbs you to the pain of living without freedom, living without a voice, living without being able to safely stand up against wrongdoing of all sorts. Mm. And it gets really, really bad, and it gets very, very personal, no matter who you are. So in Ukraine, leading up to the revolution, a friend was telling me a story of a girl and a boyfriend and girlfriend biking along in Kiev, and they just got steamrolled by some guy in a car. Oops, sorry, didn't see you there. And then they were like, they had to go to the hospital. and the guy was connected, so he got out of it. So that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's not just the big stuff, like the wars and the cruelty of the deliberate cruelty on the border. It's not just selling off our land to all these big polluting businesses and polluting for profit. It's not like Ivanka Trump enriching herself. It's not just the big stuff. It's the lack of personal power that they take away from you, and how that spreads fear and learned helplessness. And the way you overcome that as a human being, the human reaction, is normalization. That's what sets in. And a lot of these, for the population in the dictatorship, like when you're, it's like Stockholm syndrome, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? One of my big concerns is that, and this is another reason why impeachment has to be, I mean, it has to be mandatory. And my concern is that future Trumps will, and this could be happening right now, this could be developing as we speak, the idea of weaponizing this fire hose of news, where if you just commit one scandal, if you just commit one crime, well, you're going to get caught. But if you commit dozens and dozens and dozens of crimes, then the attention of the American people will be too scattered to be able to focus on any one crime, and that will allow the political cover to be able to get away with those things. And it seems to me as if impeaching him and making sure to work in all of the abuse of power articles that I think should be included in there, including his treatment of Puerto Rico, including punishing sanctuary cities and so on by sending illegal immigrants there, the whole Trump, toying with people's heads and so on. It seems to me as if, I mean, just the lies. I mean, nearly 10,000 lies since he took office. I mean, Richard Nixon, one of the articles of impeachment against Nixon had to do with his lying to the public. So it seems to me as if there were so many things. And if we don't snap him back quickly and with force, it just seems like it's tacit approval for the next guy to come along and to further weaponize that, isn't it?
Oh, without question. And I hate to say this, but from studying authoritarian regimes across the Soviet Union, it could always get worse.
Yeah.
It could always get worse than Trump. And that's what people have to understand, is that when we say normalization, when we say new norms are setting in, it's going to be a ladder for the next guy to come in. And that next guy or girl could be even more deliberately cruel and destructive.
Yep.
And so that's why we have to push back with every lever of power that we have and operate from a place of moral courage. Because if you look at, France, for instance, which had the burning of the Notre Dame, my husband's from Paris. I am very, very privileged to spend a lot of time there with his family and friends. And one thing that always stops me on the street is when I see a plaque anywhere in Paris to anyone who was killed in that spot for the French resistance. If you look at the French resistance, who in their right mind would sign up to fight in the French resistance? That was a death warrant for you and your family. Mm-hmm. Like nobody knew how long the Nazi occupation would last. Of course, people fooled themselves seeming to be liberated by Christmas and Easter and summer and so forth, but it could have been another sort of iron curtain setting in for generations.
Yep.
They had no idea how long the Nazi occupation of France would last. And so if you look at the sort of self-serving, calculating thing to do, that was to put your head down and allow for your friends and neighbors who are Jewish to have their property and their belongings stripped from them and be sent off to be murdered. And a lot of French people made that choice, saying, I'm going to keep my head down and take care of me and my family, and I'm going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But then what about the men and women who chose instead to volunteer to die by saying, I'm going to fight in the French resistance, even if it's just going to be a ragtag crew that deliberately slows down and sabotages trains before they could leave with all these innocent people on board to concentration camps. So the French Resistance wasn't just Charles de Gaulle. It was a lot of average men and women who made brave choices, putting their lives at risk and putting the lives of the people they loved at risk. Because when you are faced with actual authoritarianism, as we are now, you cannot be calculating. You cannot be self-serving. You cannot be cold. You have to come from a place of moral courage.
Yep.
Because the only force that can stand up to actual authoritarianism is moral courage.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to me as if there are a lot of people on our side of this debate, Andrea, who are just expressing fear and terror and rightfully so. I mean, I think what we're looking at is a desperately terrifying situation with Russia exerting its influence and creating chaos among Western alliances. This is absolutely maddening. But at the same time, I feel like that fear needs to be turned into anger and action, because what we're seeing now is basically a slow motion takeover of the United States, and with using our own people as foot soldiers in that endeavor.
Yeah, it's a Kremlin satellite state. This is what a satellite state looks like.
Yeah,
it's an alliance. It's an alliance of autocrats.
And you know what? Just one last thing about Russia, and I know we've been going for now an hour and 23 minutes. I hope you're not late for any appointments, but I just wanted to add this one last bit with regard to normalization. And there's a BBC documentary that came out called Hyper-Normalization. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yes, I haven't seen it yet, but I heard it's excellent.
Yeah. Well, it talks about, among other things, talks about this character Vladislav Surkov, who's an advisor to Putin, or at least was. I'm not sure what his status is currently, but he's one of the guys who actually kind of invented or maybe weaponized gaslighting in Russia. I mean, among other things, making a system of make-believe social media movements, fake social media movements, stage-managed media. These are all things that Surkov was an expert in. But his aim, according to this documentary, was not just to manipulate people, but to go deeper than that and to play with and undermine their very perception of the world. And you would talk about something that is chilling. I mean, just reading that terrifies me, because, you know, we've both been working on the internet for many, many years now, and we understand its power and we understand its influence. And when that is weaponized by hostile foreign powers like Russia and Vladimir Putin, it is absolutely and completely destructive if it's allowed to just continue, isn't it?
Without question. And it has a lasting, damaging effect. And just to give you an example, what he's talking about is not new. He's just adapting it to the 21st century.
What he's talking about
is essentially rule by terror, where you want to create the impression that you're everywhere and that your own thoughts are dependent on, or not your own, that you're completely dependent, whether you realize it or not. And that was the same sort of Soviet terror tactics that were used for generations. I mean, you had, for instance, the Russian Orthodox Church was allowed to operate in the Soviet Union because you had KGB agents all over the clergy that you had like KGB agent priests who were spying. They allowed the church to operate just so they could further, sow terror and that feeling of you're being watched and you don't know who to trust. And so what they're basically doing is breaking down what we all depend on in our lives, which is trust. Mm-hmm. And they're breaking down the fabric of trust in society. I mean, how insidious is that to have your KGB agents basically running the church,
yeah,
right? That's allowed, where the faithful turn to get through life and navigate life, and just knowing that. It was known that the KGB was doing this, and Orthodox priests would go abroad, representing the Soviet Union, but they would be KGB agents that were able to then spy and infiltrate and sort of be undetected that way. And it's this, and so and the lasting damage of it, just to give you an example, there's a great organization that sprouted up with the revolution in Ukraine called ROSM, ROSM for Ukraine. ROSM means together. Mm-hmm. And they do incredible work to, you know, fighting corruption in Ukraine, providing much needed medical support to people in Ukraine. And they asked me to speak, to moderate a discussion at their annual meeting in New York City, bringing together all these Ukrainians who are very active on causes for Ukraine. And it was a panel that I was going to moderate with some, you know, like some leading experts from Ukraine. And they asked me specifically that they wanted the topic of discussion to be about confronting the Soviet mindset. Mm-hmm. Because the Soviet mindset is so insidious that they feel that it's what's holding Ukraine back today in crawling out of its black hole of corruption and really self-actualizing into a full functioning Western democracy. Poland is decades ahead of Ukraine economically and so forth. And that's because Poland didn't have as much devastation, mm-hmm. In terms of Soviet terror as Ukraine did. Ukraine was stuck under Soviet rule for decades longer than Poland. And on top of that, as I mentioned at the start of the show, of our interview, Ukraine suffered a deliberate genocide famine where the borders were sealed and people were deliberately starved to death. And many, many millions died. By conservative estimates, 4 million were killed. And that left a lasting trauma in society, especially when you weren't allowed to talk about it. And especially as your language was stripped from you and it was replaced with Russian, and you were forced to speak Russian, and you can't even say anything, you know, you couldn't speak your own language, and your leading thinkers and everybody were taken from you. And so that created a whole lasting effect. And of course, your churches are infiltrated by KGB agents. And so what that does to people is it forces you, it takes away all your trust, what you depend on to have any mm-hmm. sort of functioning life in society. And you're forced to keep your head down. And if you were to show any sort of initiative, any sort of like sticking your head up above the crowd and go-getterness, you know, you could get shot. Like if you show any sort of entrepreneurial mindset or take any big risks, you could get shot. And so that passes on through generations, that sort of trauma and that conditioning, that today one of the top organizations working to modernize Ukraine is focusing on it deliberately, this mindset, the Soviet mindset. They've declared war on undoing the trauma of the Soviet mindset because they feel that it is instrumental in holding Ukraine back today. So that shows you that the Kremlin has it right, that you've got to infiltrate people's minds, that you've got to destroy that trust.
Yeah.
And so they create this bizarre carnival of misinformation that you're bombarded with, and it's just going to get worse with technology. You'll see, it's going to get so much worse. and what happens is trust is the first casualty. Mm. Trust breaks down, and you just check out, and you don't know who to believe anymore. You don't know how to engage. You don't know how to filter information. All of it. And so you start to develop your own sort of coping skills of trying to understand what's going on, and realizing that you're using their own coping skills, whatever they're pushing on you. And so it is a very destructive, self-destructive mind hijacking that the Kremlin is known for and has depended on for decades. And Ukraine itself is still struggling with this today. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're being subjected to a mass delusion right now. I'm absolutely convinced, mm-hmm. and it's because of this this Russian attack, and so it's absolutely crucial that and I try to do this as often as possible, but to remind people that they're not going crazy, that they should believe what they're seeing, because what they're seeing is desperately awful and dangerous, and the more we're linked into the reality that we see with our own two eyes, the better off we're going to be. And as soon as we just say, hey, you know what, it seems useless to deal with this, I'm just done, I'm out, bye, that's when they win.
I mean, exactly right.
Yeah. And you and Sarah are doing such amazing work with your podcast. I'm so gratified by seeing all of your success and doing such critically important work. Please don't ever stop. That's all to say. This is all to say.
Thank you so much. That's so nice to hear.
All right.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's It's like when the U.S. was in that the American Revolution, they had like the pub culture, right? Like everybody would go out to the bars and exchange ideas that way. The whole cafe culture in Europe in like the 1920s, where people, you know, the whole intellectual movement's being born out of the cafe movement. Mm. And podcasting just feels like an extension of that, right?
Yeah.
It feels like it feels like we're just sitting in and talking building community and ideas that way.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah. And it's great. I'm hoping that Facebook doesn't screw it all up because Facebook,
right.
I think Facebook ultimately screwed digital publishing. And I don't know if you guys are seeing any downsides to Facebook's ongoing fuckery, but they're constantly throttling people who aren't linking within Facebook. I find that any outside links.
Look, when I said earlier, imagine something worse than Trump, that would be President Mark Zuckerberg. That would be worse than Trump.
Oh, my God. I think it would. Yeah, I guess on the list of things that would be worse than Trump, as far as I'm concerned, I think if Don Jr. ever became president, that would be
they'd all be in the same administration anyway. Zuckerberg and Ivanka and everyone.
I think Don Jr. would nominate Zuckerberg to be his running mate, which would be terrifying. I have all kinds of horrible nightmares to inject into the world, don't I? I can come up with even things that are even worse than that. But Andrea, thank you so much for all of your time. I didn't anticipate we would go this long, but I really appreciate you sticking around and talking to everybody about. I think it's so important to hear from Russia experts when we're talking about these things, because I think in a lot of ways Russia has been a black box. I don't think we have any real and full understanding of what really happened. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much for your time, and thanks for all you do, Bob. It was so great to connect with you.
Yeah, definitely. Good luck with Mr. Jones, and it'll hit theaters this fall or winter, right?
Yeah. So we'll find out soon. We just finished this final cut, and so, we'll know. Fall, winter 2019.
All right, sounds great. If you want to follow the film on Twitter, at Mr. Jones_film, and I'll put links in the description below, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you again, Andre. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Bob.
We'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.